Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 856, Libertarianism, White Supremacy, and Leaderless Resistance. This program is being recorded on July 26th of the year 2015. We are once again going to be looking at what to many people will appear to be a very strange amalgamation of individuals, and we're going to be looking at not only elements of political continuity between these seemingly diverse elements and individuals, but we're going to be taking a look at what really amounts to something of a, if not a philosophical revolution, certainly something that is emblematic of one and that has largely gone unrecognized. There has been a lot of publicity in recent weeks, of course, about not only the Charleston church massacre allegedly or apparently perpetrated by Dylann Roof, but also the publicity. There have been a number of African-American churches that have burned. We've also seen a number of lone nut, unquote, shooters going off in various contexts. I'm not going to be talking here about the fellow who allegedly shot military recruiters in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I will simply note that not only did this Muslim fellow attend a Muslim Brotherhood mosque, but he traveled to Jordan and visited with an uncle, and his uncle is now being represented in Jordan by a Muslim Brotherhood attorney. It would appear that the Chattanooga shooter also had some psychological problems and some substance abuse problems, may perhaps have sought Muslim or Islamic totalitarianism and martyrdom as a means of expunging his spiritual CV, so to speak. But certainly I think that whatever the relative stability of the individual in question, the fact that his Muslim worship and also now his uncle's legal representation are at one with the milieu of the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist organization, I don't think is something that we can ignore, though we're not going to go into it here. We also have seen a shooting in yet another movie theater, this one in Lafayette, Louisiana. We're going to take a look at the profile of John Hauser here. Hauser also appears to have had some psychological problems. However, he also had been politically indoctrinated by the far right and Nazi elements. How exactly that played into what he allegedly did at the movie theater in Louisiana is a matter of speculation as well. However, what we're going to be looking at is a political, really I would call it a mislabeling, although these elements certainly would be, they fall under the libertarian rubric. I think using the term libertarians or anything that derives from the word liberty is most inappropriate. Libertarianism has a strong, superficial appeal to people who believe in liberty and who are disillusioned with both governmental and corporate institutions. However, under the rubric of libertarianism and under the libertarian milieu to which Eddie Snowden has appealed and from which he apparently evolved, we are seeing people who are of the exact opposite stripe, and we're going to look at that this evening, or in this program as well. When you, as I've said so many times, when you scratch the milieu of Edward Snowden, you come across the milieu of Ron Paul, his presidential candidate of choice, the man to whom he contributed, to whose campaign he contributed money, the man whose chief legal counsel for his 2012 campaign was Edward Snowden's first attorney, and who is the attorney for the Snowden family and established a nonprofit with Lon Snowden, Edward Snowden's father. When you look at the milieu surrounding Ron Paul and his political admirer, Edward Snowden, you come across people like the League of the South. We're going to come back to that this evening. You come across people who not only felt that the Confederacy was justified, but that the South should do it again, and that African-American slavery was a good thing. It may even be beyond African-American. One of Snowden's political idol Ron Paul's top advisors is a guy named Walter Block from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, who has developed a theory he calls voluntary slavery, which, as I have discussed in the past, is not only the arguably the ultimate oxymoron, but perhaps the ultimate in collateralized death obligation. It may seem to be a long, long stretch going from libertarians and the people around Edward Snowden to the interests that apparently inspired Dylann Roof in what he allegedly did in Charleston, South Carolina. But as we are going to see, that is not a reach at all. We're going to be revisiting Ron Paul's racist newsletters, which apparently were co-authored or tri-authored or authored in part by a fellow named Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey Tucker is described as a co-founder of the League of the South, arguably the top neo-Confederate organization, although he denies membership in the group. He is associated with the Ludwig von Mises Institute, as is Lou Rockwell, another of the apparent authors of Ron Paul's newsletters. And as we're going to see, Jeffrey Tucker talks the talk of the new tech-savvy techno-libertarian. As we are going to see, he is in fact part and parcel to the deep, almost antediluvian racism that is to be found in Ron Paul's newsletters, and that apparently inspired Dylann Roof as well. Dylann Roof drew inspiration from the neo-Confederate movement and apparently made statements that he was going to do something to start a white revolution. He was moved in part by what he examined in connection with the Trayvon Martin killing. And I would note that what Dylann Roof manifested, what a fellow named Glenn Fraser apparently manifested in Kansas, and what John Hauser apparently manifested down in Lafayette, Louisiana, is what is called the lone wolf or leaderless resistance strategy. This is a strategy in which a Nazi or fascist organization would not be limited to them by any means. Others can do it. The Muslim Brotherhood and all apparent offshoots like ISIS have done this very well. What they do is to advocate that followers of their ideology, people who agree with them philosophically, pick up the gun and take matters into their own hands, but do so on their own initiative, and in such a way as not to implicate the advocating organization. As we have seen, Glenn Greenwald, Edward Snowden's leaking journalist of choice, spent years running interference for the leaderless resistance or lone wolf strategy, basically seeing to it that organizations which more or less explicitly, sometimes obliquely, advocate racist violence cannot be held account civilly for that violence. It should be noted that this is not a question of banning constitutionally allowed free speech. It's not a question of making this illegal, but rather it is a question of holding people responsible, having them maintain civil liability for the actions of people who have been following their political pronouncements. What Greenwald did was to run interference for organizations like the National Alliance, whose books are intended as teaching tools to basically teach their followers how to engage in acts of violence. But Greenwald saw to it to an extent, spent years doing it, and doing it pro bono. This in his previous professional incarnation as an attorney. He spent years seeing to it that organizations like the National Alliance could not be held to civil liability for advocating the things that were then put into practice by the political adherents of their organization. It is that lone wolf or leaderless resistance strategy that is front and center in not only the Charleston church massacre, but may very well be behind the burning of a number of other black churches as well. One of the things that we're going to be looking at concerns the consistent role of our media in downplaying the significance of these events. Even though the Charleston church massacre was followed by a series of burnings of African-American churches, mainstream media such as the Washington Post and New York Times have downplayed the possibility of any link between them. What they have not spoken about is that these may very well be acts of leaderless resistance performed by the very kinds of lone wolves whose civic sanctity and sanitization from the organizations that inspired them were guaranteed by Glenn Greenwald. We're also going to be taking a look at a guy named Harold Covington. He is a Nazi leader whose work apparently inspired Bill and Ruth to a certain extent. And Harold Covington is an interesting fellow. He was linked with a group of Klansmen and Nazis who shot down a number of protesters in Greensboro, North Carolina, many of them members of a communist, an explicitly communist group. And Harold Covington also apparently had as one of his Nazi followers none other than John Hinckley Jr., the fellow who allegedly shot Ronald Reagan. However, in the media's coverage of John Hinckley, once again, things were sanitized and he was made out to be a lone nut rather than a Nazi. And the links to the Bush family milieu and even to elements of CIA were either not acknowledged or completely blacked out. I will also note that in connection with one of the most famous acts of violence against a black church, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in the spring of 1963, the evidentiary tributaries linking that act and the assassination of Martin Luther King, and even running in the direction of the assassination of President Kennedy, have been obscured. We're also going to take a look again at how our media operate. In the wake of the Charleston massacre, there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times by Morris Dees of the Southern Poverty Law Center. They do very good work as far as they go, but that isn't far enough. And it mentioned that a fellow named Robert Whitaker was running for vice president in 2016. But what neither the New York Times nor Morris Dees informed us that this very same Robert or Bob Whitaker was a key Reagan administration White House staffer involved with, among other things, security clearances for people in the Reagan White House. That is an interesting position for somebody like Robert Whitaker to hold, and yet we hear nothing about that from the New York Times or from the Southern Poverty Law Center. And indeed, when some of these Nazi or white supremacist actors, whether lone wolves or acting as part of an organized set-piece conspiracy, when they come to light, they are systematically whitewashed, pun intended, by our media, who will not acknowledge the institutional connections. We're going to be taking a look, too, at what might be called the Northwest Imperative. For a long time, Nazi and white supremacist elements have looked to annex some North American states and British Columbia to establish a, quote, Aryan homeland in the Pacific Northwest. This is something that was advocated by Harold Covington, again, an apparent influence on Dylan Roof. And we're going to be taking a look at a couple of things that took place in the Portland area, where a captain on the Portland, Oregon police force did a tribute to Nazi-era German soldiers and also alleged racist violence or racist baiting that has gone unaddressed at the Daimler Trucks Portland, Oregon plant in Oregon. We're going to conclude by taking a look at a German industrialist named Fokker, who was buying a whole lot of property in the Pacific Northwest, and into whose service a guy named Rick Bohlke apparently went. Rick Bohlke, in turn, very, very close to Rudi Dekkers of Huffman Aviation, and it was German industrialist Fokker's protege, Rick Bohlke, who founded Florida Air, an apparent phantom airline that was not only endorsed by Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State of the state of Florida under then Governor Jeb Bush, but also was used, that the Florida Air, that is, of Rick Bohlke, was used by Rudi Dekkers and company to lure Arab and German pilots to Huffman Aviation. And the apparent financial angel for Rick Bohlke, an associate of Dekkers and Appa, was none other than German industrialist Fokker, who is buying up a whole lot of property in the Pacific Northwest. That's what we have on tap for the show.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com. Also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, this past week there was a shooting in a movie theater in Lafayette, Louisiana. The alleged perpetrator was a guy named John Hauser, and the news accounts of Hauser basically made him out to be a nut, and indeed he may very well not have been wrapped too tight. Yet there was more to John Russell Hauser than just being having too many birds on his antenna. An article on the Yahoo News of July 24th of 2015, this is by Michael Walsh, W-A-L-S-H, John Russell Hauser, what we know about Louisiana movie theater shooting suspect. And in addition to, you know, all sorts of personal troubles and the fact that a lot of people, including his wife, apparently were afraid of him, we see the following skipping down. Turns out, Hauser was a politically active individual with far right-wing and fascist points of view. Not only that, but he was an advocate for the type of lone wolf stratagem that has been put into practice, by people like, apparently, Dylann Roof. Speaking of John Russell Hauser, quote, he had Tea Party radical Republican views on everything. This is a fellow who had him on as a cable TV guest. I'd have a Democratic spokesperson for the opposing perspective. He generated a lot of phone calls. Hauser was a member of Tea Party Nation, according to the group's website. The Hate Watch blog, which is run by the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center, uncovered that Hauser posted about his fondness for Adolf Hitler, neo-Nazis, and lone wolves on several online forums. Quote, do not be mistaken for 1 minute. The enemy sees all posted on this website, unquote. He wrote on a site dedicated to the New York chapter of Greece's far-right Golden Dawn, which espouses fascist and neo-Nazi ideologies. Quote, I do not want to discourage the last hope for the best, but you must realize the power of the lone wolf. It is the power that can come forth in all situations. Look within yourselves, he continued. Elsewhere on the U.S. message board, a political discussion forum, he wrote, quote, Hitler accomplished far more than any other through, quote, pragmatically forming, unquote. So again, although Hauser may very well have had psychological problems, it looks like he did. He also had political problems, and he not only had a far right-wing slash Nazi orientation, but he was an advocate of the lone wolf slash leaderless resistance strategy, which he apparently put into effect to a certain extent. What we're going to do next is to revisit an article that we looked at in, For the Record, 851. Now, again, by way of understanding the ideological generating forces that appear to have had an influence on Dylann Roof, we're going to look at another article. This from the Pando Daily of May 1st of 2015. The article is by Mark Ames, A-M-E-S, and it's titled Baltimore and The Walking Dead. Now, what is being discussed here are some of Ron Paul's racist newsletters. And these are things that certainly generated gravitas for the political vector, the political vector that Dylann Roof was part of. Now, again, both of them are in The Walking Dead by Mark Ames and of Ron Paul's newsletters in the 1990s. And bear in mind that one of the things that Dylann Roof allegedly was influenced by was the Trayvon Martin shooting by George Zimmerman. He also was influenced by the neo-Confederate movement and also, as we will see, by the Northwest Imperative movement, people associated with Harold Covington and other Nazis and white supremacists who are advocating having the Pacific Northwest as a, quote, Aryan homeland. Bear in mind that Ron Paul is Edward Snowden's political idol or candidate of choice, and that Ron Paul's chief legal counsel for his 2012 campaign was Edward Snowden's first attorney and is the attorney for the Snowden family, having formed a nonprofit with Edward Snowden's father, Lon Snowden. After the 1992 Los Angeles riots, Ron Paul wrote the following in the Ron Paul Political Report. Quote, the criminals who terrorize our cities in riots and on every non-riot day are not exclusively young black males, but they largely are. As children, they are trained to hate whites, to believe that white oppression is responsible for all black ills, to, quote, fight the power, unquote, to steal and loot as much money from the white enemy as possible. The cause of the riots is plain. Barbarism. If the barbarians cannot loot sufficiently through legal channels, i.e. the riots being the welfare state minus the middleman, they resort to illegal ones, to terrorism. Trouble is, few seem willing to stop them. The cops have been handcuffed. We are constantly told that it is evil to be afraid of black men, but it is hardly irrational. Black men commit murders, rapes, robberies, muggings, and burglaries all out of proportion to their numbers in our society. I think we can safely assume that 95% of the black males in major U.S. cities are either semi-criminal or entirely criminal, unquote. A few months later, in October of 1992, Dr. Paul explained how he taught his own family, presumably including his favorite son, Rand Paul, how to defend themselves and even murder what Dr. Paul called, quote, hip-hop, unquote, carjackers, again quoting, the urban youth who play unsuspecting whites like pianos, unquote. And quoting from the Ron Paul Political Report from October of 1992, what can you do? More and more Americans are carrying a gun in the car. An ex-cop I know advises that if you have to use a gun on the black youth, you should leave the scene immediately, disposing of the wiped-off gun as soon as possible. Such a gun cannot, of course, be registered to you, but one bought privately through the classifieds, for example. And again, looking at the template established here and seeing things like the Trayvon Martin killing and things that have evolved from these kinds of views. Again, when I talk about the forces allied with Edward Snowden being the same forces that are to be found in the background, really not just the background, but the foreground of the act apparently committed by Dylann Roof. Again, I'm not engaging in hyperbole. More from The Walking Dead by Mark Ames from Panda Daily of May 1st of 2015. Beyond that, the Libertarian Party's political solution to African-American poverty and injustice was to abolish all welfare programs, public schools, and anti-discrimination laws like the Civil Rights Act. This was a solution promoted by an up-and-coming libertarian, Jacob Hornberger, H-O-R-N-B-E-R-G-E-R, who this week co-hosted an event with Ron Paul, parenthetically Edward Snowden's political idol, and Glenn Greenwald, parenthetically Edward Snowden's leaking journalist of choice. Hornberger believes that 19th-century antebellum slave-era America was, quote, the freest society in history, unquote. Now, again, we're going to take a look at another person who has, to an extent, rebranded himself as a, quote, libertarian, unquote, or as a technocrat, although much of what he has to say could be almost called technocratic sedition. However, as we are going to see, the person we're going to be talking about, Jeffrey Tucker, is, yes, a member of the neo-Confederate movement and someone who apparently helped to write the Ron Paul Political Report along with fellow League of the South and Ludwig von Mises associate Lou Rockwell. And after we take a look at Jeffrey Tucker and what he really represents, we're going to review review a crystallization of one of the most important articles, I think, that has been written in a long time. It is by David Galumbi in uncomputing.org. But first, let's take a look at Jeffrey Tucker. The Pando Daily of July 16th of 2015 has an article by Paul Carr, C-A-R-R. It's called "Imagine If the Uber Is a Good Start Guy Turned Out to Be a Crazy Racist Homophobe." This is a good article. I think, however, although it's very understandable, I'm not finding fault with Paul Carr. Turning these people as crazy is really missing the point. It's like saying Adolf Hitler was crazy or he was a nut. No, he was a Nazi. He was a fascist. He was not crazy. And I think people who would readily label people who hold the kinds of views that Jeffrey Tucker holds as crazy are, in a sense, failing to recognize how deliberately and willfully dangerous these people are. Skipping down in Paul Carr's Pando Daily article. Earlier this week, I described the most terrifying moment of my visit to the Freedom Fest Libertarian Conference in Las Vegas. It came during a panel about, quote, hacking the state, unquote, where a publisher named Jeffrey, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y, Tucker, T-U-C-K-E-R, described his vision for a world where technology has disrupted away all regulations and laws. Uber, argued Tucker, was a good, quote, first step, unquote, down that road, but was held back by Travis Kalanick's, K-A-L-A-N-I-C-K's, insistence on regulating the behavior of his drivers. Tucker also said that the only victims he felt sorry for were those who had been jailed for creating libertarian trading platforms for drugs and other illegal products and services. I cry about my friend Silk Road founder Ross Ulbricht. There is so much injustice in the world. If any of you want to minister to prisoners, this is a good time, unquote. By the way, Ross Ulbricht was also a follower of Ron and Rand Paul. Continuing. As I wrote, Tucker came across as a full-fledged sociopath, someone who would see the world burn and call it progress. I suggested that Tucker represents a new breed of modern, tech-savvy libertarians, the old racist guard of libertarians having withered away, skipping down. It turns out I was wrong. In fact, Tucker allegedly had a starring role in the most vile, most racist, and most infamous episode in the previous incarnation of libertarianism, Ron Paul's racist newsletters, skipping down. And it talks about the evidence suggesting that Jeffrey Tucker, along with Lou Rockwell, was deeply involved with writing the Ron Paul Political Report. I don't exonerate Ron Paul. He signed it. He put his name on it. And, you know, when he claims it, I don't know what was in there. Well, that is not being libertarian. That is denying responsibility for something for which you are clearly responsible and claiming you don't know what's in the political report that carries your name and your signature. That is inadequate. Skipping down in the Pando Daily. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, Jeffrey Tucker is a full-on neo-Confederate. Both Lou Rockwell, the other alleged author of the racist Ron Paul newsletters, and Ludwig von Mises Institute researcher Jeffrey Tucker, are listed on the Racist League of the South's website as founding members, and both men deny their membership. Tucker has written for League publications, and many League members have taught at the Ludwig von Mises Institute seminars and given presentations at its conferences. If Tucker denies his membership, then of course we have to take him at his word. Hopefully, Tucker was able to clear up the misunderstanding when he co-hosted a session at the Young Americans for Liberty Conference with former League of the South chairman and Rand Paul staffer, Jack Southern Avenger Hunter. By the way, he writes Ron Paul here. He was actually Ron Paul's chief blogger for his 2012 campaign and now works as an aide for Rand Paul, Ron Paul's son.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
Now, considering that what we heard from Jeffrey Tucker, where initially Paul carved the Pando Daily, said this guy sounds sort of like a classic neo-libertarian, albeit a full-fledged sociopath who's talking about using technology to bring down the state. I would ask people to consider a very, very important article that was written by David Golumbia, G-O-L-U-M-B-I-A, this in the uncomputing.org blog of April 23rd of 2015. I've used this in several recent programs, initially in For the Record 851. And what David Golumbia is really talking about here is an important development in which coders, and this would include big tech as well as hackers of various types, are at one in espousing a type of what I have called technocratic fascism or technocratic libertarian fascism, in which basically the coders do whatever they see fit to the political realm or in the political realm, and the various polities that to which their will is subject basically have no say in the matter. And I would suggest that Jeffrey Tucker fits very precisely in this framework. Again, described as a founding member of the League of the South, and apparently along with another associate of the League, Lou Rockwell, the main contributors to the Ron Paul Political Report. Again, Toward Technocracy and Democracy from David Golumbia in uncomputing.org of April 23rd of 2015, telescoping the basics of this story. Golumbia writes, such technocratic beliefs are widespread in our world today, especially in the enclaves of digital enthusiasts, whether or not they are part of the giant corporate digital leviathan. Hackers, civic, ethical, white and black hat alike, hacktivists, WikiLeaks fans and Julian Assange, anonymous members, even Edward Snowden himself, walk hand in hand with Facebook and Google in telling us that coders don't just have good things to contribute to the political world, but that the political world is theirs to do with what they want, and the rest of us should stay out of it. The political world is broken, they appear to think, rightly, at least in part, and the solution to that, they think, wrongly, at least for the most part, is for programmers to take political matters into their own hands. First, Tor co-creator Dingleline claimed that Tor must be supported because it follows directly from a fundamental right to privacy, unquote. Yet when pressed, and not that hard, he admits that what he means by right to privacy, unquote, is not what any human rights body or particular legal regime, unquote, has ever meant by it. Instead of talking about how human rights are protected, he asserts that human rights are natural rights and that these natural rights create natural law that is properly enforced by entities above and outside of democratic polities. Where the UN's Universal Declaration on Human Rights of 1948 is very clear that states and bodies like the UN, to which states belong, are the exclusive guarantors of human rights, whatever the origin of those rights, Dingleline and the coders assert that a small group of software developers can assign to themselves that role, and that members of democratic polities have no choice but to accept them having that role. That is a very, very interesting political philosophy. And I think that it is one, as David Columbia has written, that not only unites people like the anonymous people, white and black hat hackers, WikiLeaks fans, Edward Snowden himself. I would suggest that many of what Paul Carr saw as the new wave of libertarians, and as he found out, this new wave libertarian, Jeffrey Tucker, is just like the old wave libertarians. I would put them in a similar category, basically. They're saying that, well, the political system is broken, and we're going to do whatever we think is best, regardless of who cares and what we do about it. We're going to take a look at another of the influences on Dylan Roof, apparently. This is an American Nazi named Harold Covington. We have come across Covington in previous shows. In AFA 13, we took a look at the Greensboro Massacre of 1979, in which Covington was apparently a minor participant, and in which a combined group of Klansmen and Nazis, with considerable participation by agents of FBI informers and agents of the ATF, gunned down a bunch of communist protesters and union organizers in Greensboro, North Carolina, something that I know that was great publicity for the Klan and the Nazis. Basically, they could present themselves as defenders against the communist menace. We also took a look at Harold Covington in For the Record program number 244. Harold Covington was head of a Nazi group to which John Hinckley belonged at one point. Hinckley was convicted of shooting President Reagan. He was also the son of one of George Herbert Walker Bush's main campaign contributors when George H.W. Bush was challenging Ronald Reagan for the 1980 presidential nomination. And Neil Bush, the son of George H.W. Bush and a brother of both George W. Bush and Jeb Bush, Neil Bush was scheduled to have dinner with Scott Hinckley, John Hinckley's older brother, the night after the shooting. It has also been noted that the elder John Hinckley, in addition to being the main primary campaign contributor of George Herbert Walker Bush in the 1980 primary elections, was also a major funder of World Vision, which has been used as a CIA front organization in both Latin America and Southeast Asia, according to the Christian Science Monitor, among other papers. However, note that when it comes to things like that, the mainstream media just don't see anything about it. Harold Covington, as we're going to see, is also an advocate of the Pacific, or the Northwest Imperative, as it's sometimes called. This is an ideological movement among Nazis and white supremacists to take over the Pacific Northwest and set it up as a white supremacist homeland. Article about Harold Covington. By the way, note that Covington also writes racist novels, which are not just intended for entertainment. They are intended sort of as instructional materials, like the novels of the National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance. And it was in justification of the, quote, free speech, unquote, rights of National Alliance and their instructional manual novels that Glenn Greenwald lobbied when he was an attorney. So when we look at Harold Covington's literary efforts, we are looking at something that is at one with what Glenn Greenwald stood up for, basically ran legal interference for when he was an attorney. Now, about Hinckley associate Harold Covington, one of the apparent influences on Dylan Roof. This is from the British Guardian of June 28th of 2015, an article by Sam Thielman, T-H-I-E-L-M-A-N. White supremacist calls Charleston, quote, a preview of coming attractions, unquote, and it reads in part as follows. Dylan Roof refers to Harold Covington's white separatist group, the Northwest Front, in his alleged manifesto. For right-wing sci-fi writer distances himself from the shooting, but his followers speculate if his work influenced Ruth's actions. One of the shadowy figures who appears to have influenced alleged Charleston killer Dylan Roof is Harold Covington, the founder of the white separatist movement and, within supremacist circles, an influential sci-fi author. Covington, the latest in a long line of right-wing sci-fi writers, has been linked to racist crimes in the past, and this week called the massacre in Charleston, quote, a preview of coming attractions, unquote. Note that, because we're going to take a look at what may have been coming. Returning to the article, the racist manifesto and photos apparently posted by Ruth makes mention of the Northwest Front, created by Covington, a former member of the American Nazi Party who traveled to South Africa and Rhodesia in order to agitate for white power. In the accompanying photos, Ruth wore patches with Rhodesian and apartheid-era South African flags on them. Covington, if you believe his website, runs a glowing enclave of white supremacists near Seattle called the Northwest Front. The nonprofit group is reflected in a series of sci-fi novels authored by Covington about a dystopian future in which a white nation is the only answer to U.S. economic and racial woes, very much like the novels of the National Alliance. Skipping down again. Covington doesn't advocate for randomized violence. He wants revolution to the extent that he calls his followers comrades, unquote, and lectures them on, quote, the purpose of revolution, among other phrases more characteristic of the left than the right. While it was clear Roof knew about the Northwest Front and seemed familiar with it, Covington condemned Roof's shooting on his Tuesday podcast because, quote, it doesn't work, unquote, skipping down. The Ruth killings are not the first time Covington's name has come up in connection with an allegedly racist murder. Covington was part of a group of white supremacists in the 1970s who massacred black people at a rally in Greensboro, North Carolina. He, Covington, was also at one time close to Fraser Glenn Miller, who was charged with killing a woman, a 69-year-old white man, and that man's 14-year-old grandson near Jewish institutions last year. I would point out that Fraser Glenn Miller was also very close to Joseph Paul Franklin, and the National Vanguard book / National Alliance novel Hunter, unquote, is dedicated to Joseph Paul Franklin. And William Luther Pierce, the author of that book, made it very clear that that book about a racist assassin who goes around killing people of color and interracial couples in particular was meant as an instructional manual for just those sorts of things. Now, returning to the article from The Guardian of June 28th and about Harold Covington. The Northwest novels, quote, are not meant to be mere entertainment, unquote, according to Covington's website, northwest.org. They are meant to be self-fulfilling prophecies. The author wishes to inspire the creation of a real Northwest American Republic, and his novels are filled with a great deal of sound, practical advice about how to do it. There are 5 Northwest novels, and all are populated with similarly brave and heroic white men, in the words of Shane Ryan, the narrator of Covington's A Distant Thunder. Cool, D.W. Griffith-style black people whose speech is written in dialect also populate the novels, as well as hand-wringing liberals who want nothing more than to stifle the right of free speech of white people who just want to secede from the United States. And again, in connection with the Charleston shootings, Harold Covington said, this is a preview of coming attractions.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Now again, Harold Covington, who was one of the apparent influences on Dylan Roof, who, by the way, said that he was doing what he was doing because he wanted to start a, quote, revolution, unquote, or an uprising by white people. And, black people committing crimes and raping women, just the kinds of things that were advocated were discussed in the Ron Paul Political Report. Following the Charleston massacre, there has been a series of burnings and, in many cases, arson attacks against black churches. However, the authorities have been downplaying this. From the International Business Times of July 15th of 2015, an article by Julia Glum, G-L-U-M, Black Church Burnings, Houston's Fifth Ward Missionary Baptist Latest to Catch Fire. This reads in part, authorities reported early Wednesday morning on a fire on Houston's Fifth Ward Missionary Baptist Church, the latest in a rash of burnings of predominantly black religious institutions. Nobody was injured in Wednesday's fire, but the Texas church was significantly damaged, KHOU reported. It took firefighters about 30 minutes to extinguish the flames. The Houston Chronicle reported that officials were investigating what caused the fire, which was first reported at 7:34 a.m. News of the blaze came in as police in other states were looking into similar incidents at other churches across the South over the past month. The FBI and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives were reportedly working with local agencies to determine whether the fires were connected. At least six churches have been burned since a white shooter killed nine black people during a June 17th massacre at the historically black Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. The fatal shooting set off a nationwide discussion about race relations in the U.S. And then there is a listing of the churches that have burned. Now, interestingly, the media have downplayed the possibility that these may be connected. This noted in, among other places, the Think Progress blog of July 1st of 2015, article by Jack Jenkins, Why Unconnected, Unquote, Church Burnings Can Still Be Racist, and talks about some of the coverage. When news broke late Tuesday evening that yet another black church, Mount Zion AME Church in Greeleyville, South Carolina, were on fire, the internet erupted with outrage. People on Twitter noted that Mount Zion, which also was burned in the 1990s by members of the KKK, is the seventh predominantly African-American church to burn to the ground in the past few weeks, and began venting their frustration using the hashtag who is burning black churches, unquote. In response to the anger over church burnings that has been building for weeks, some media outlets such as the Washington Post's The Fix blog have contended that attacks on black churches are not actually on the rise, suggesting the media is giving unwarranted coverage to the fires in the aftermath of the recent shooting of nine black churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina. Along similar lines, the New York Times published a story on Tuesday purporting that there was no evidence that the arsons were hate crimes, citing investigators who said that even the intentional fires were merely acts of, quote, vandalism, unquote. Another article talking about the, I don't know about whistling through the graveyard, but certainly ignoring the possibility that these acts may be connected, that they may be acts of lone wolf terrorism or leaderless resistance inspired by the, quote, free speech, unquote, for which Glenn Greenwald spent years running legal interference. An article by the TPM Cafe Opinion of July 13th of 2015, Why the Media Refused to Connect Those Church Fires with Races by Carolyn J. Davis, and notes a history of violence against black African-American houses of worship in the U.S. Most of this article is in the description for the Record 856, which will be published shortly after the program is recorded. What I would note is that, again, just as the media, I don't know, are dismissing, but simply have not taken into account that, yeah, actually these church burnings may be connected, not that the same organization is involved at the operational level, but that individuals who have been indoctrinated in such a fashion by websites or novels or whatever or a combination thereof have been taking it upon themselves to do what John Hauser espoused, basically the power of the lone wolf, to embrace leaderless resistance, as Glenn Fraser Miller is alleged to have done, as Dylann Roof apparently did, as John Houser may very well have done, and they simply don't take the possibility of leaderless resistance into account. I would note that the media and our history books have functioned in a very similar fashion with regard to one of the most famous acts of terrorism and violence against a black church. That is the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in the spring of 1963, in which four young African-American girls were killed by a bomb. And that bombing, by the way, is portrayed in the recent film Selma. But what isn't portrayed in Selma or much of any place else outside of the archives for this program and the SpitfireList.com website and a few other printed sources. First of all, a Ku Klux Klansman named Ray Chambliss. His last name is Chambliss. I don't know about the first name off the top of my head. Robert Chambliss, not Ray Chambliss. But Robert Chambliss was convicted of the killings. He was represented in his long legal struggle, which eventually ended in his conviction, by a guy named Arthur Haynes. Arthur Haynes was the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, at the time of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. He also was a former contract agent for the CIA, having flown B-26s for the Bay of Pigs invasion. I would also note that Arthur Haynes was one of the so-called defense attorneys for James Earl Ray, the patsy who took the fall for the assassination of Martin Luther King. There was a recording made by a Miami police undercover informant of a National States Rights Party member named Joseph Adams Miltier in the fall of 1963. In that recording, Miltier discussed plans to kill both Martin Luther King and President Kennedy using high-powered rifles with telescopic sights firing from a high-rise building. He also discussed the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing as well. Now, again, Miltier was a member of the National States Rights Party. The head of the National States Rights Party, Jesse Stoner, was another of James Earl Ray's defense attorneys. And James Earl Ray's brother, Jerry Ray, was a member of the NSRP and a bodyguard for J.B. Stoner. But you never hear about some of these, what for lack of a better term might be called institutional slash conspiratorial links between the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing and the killing of Martin Luther King, or even the assassination of JFK. A similar sanitization process took place. Again, this is pretty much standard operating procedure. In the wake of the Charleston shooting, there was an op-ed column by Morris Dees and Richard Cohen in the New York Times of June 22nd of 2015, White Supremacists Without Borders, and it talks about how white supremacists are using the internet and other forms of media to spread their message. And then notes the following. The white nationalist American Freedom Party has made the mantra's author, a segregationist from South Carolina named Robert Whitaker, its vice presidential candidate in 2016. Slogan is, diversity equals white genocide, and diversity means chasing down the last white person. And they mentioned correctly that this South Carolina white supremacist named Robert Whitaker is running as the VP candidate for the American Freedom Party. They do not mention, however, that this is not his first brush with politics. From the American Dissident Voices program that is on the white supremacist Stormfront website, there was an interview by Kevin Alfred Strom, S-T-R-O-M, with Robert Whitaker. A White Future is Coming, an interview with Bob Whitaker. And skipping down, Whitaker has this to say, I was special assistant to the director of the Office of Personnel Management in charge of security clearances, staffing, and that sort of thing. This, by the way, for the Reagan administration, undoubtedly working as one of Helena von Baum's charges as well. And again, note that the New York Times and the Southern Poverty Law Center don't mention that Whitaker was a Reagan White House staffer. couple of articles indicating that perhaps the Northwest imperative espoused by Harold Covington is not as much of a pipe dream as a lot of people might think. The Portland Oregonian of July 16th of 2014. Portland Police Captain Mark Kruger's past discipline to be erased, including tribute to Nazi-era soldiers under city settlement, this by Maxine Bernstein, skipping down. As part of the unusual settlement with Kruger, the city agreed to pay him back for the 80 hours suspension without pay he received in 2010 for mailing, quote, memorial plaques, unquote, of five Nazi soldiers to a tree on the east side of Rocky Butte Park sometime between 1999 and 2001. Interesting thing for a Portland, Oregon police captain to be doing. And also in the Portland area, this from the KGW.com of October 1st of 2014, an article by Sarah Roth, R-O-T-H, Daimler under investigation after racist and violent allegations. Daimler Trucks North America is under investigation after allegations of racist language and violent threats were made by at least five employees in North Portland, the Bureau of Labor and Industries announced Wednesday. The complaints basically were that the Daimler company were not sufficiently vigorous in chasing down or investigating these threats. What we're going to do by way of conclusion is to revisit material that we looked at in, for the record, 483, 484, and also 761. In his landmark book, Welcome to Terrorland, Muhammad Atta and the 9/11 Cover-Up in Florida, Daniel Hopsicker notes that one of the people who worked with Rudy Deckers of Huffman Aviation, who ran the flight schools through which Muhammad Atta and company infiltrated the U.S. and which certainly appeared to have many links to the intelligence community and organized crime and the underground Reich. One of those fellows was a guy named Rick Bolke. And Rick Bolke, we read in the book, who had Rudy Deckers and company been working for? We didn't know anyone who could just walk up and ask. We got a clue from Mike Pickett, the aviation executive who had watched Rick Bolke, B-O-E-H-L-K-E, with the same amazement with which aviation professionals in Florida watched Deckers. Quote, when Bolke came in, he was just a restaurateur at the Gig Harbor Airport, he said. Then he became the general manager for a German named Folker, F-O-L-K-E-R, a German industrialist buying up all the land in that area. Gig Harbor's in Washington, by the way, Washington State. More Germans. Jessica Bailey, an attractive airline professional in her late 20s, worked for Rick Bolke of Harbor Air and later transferred and worked for Rudy Deckers at Florida Air. While Harbor Air was going under, Bolke told Jessica to fly down to Florida and see Rudy. When I walked into Rudy's office, he was yelling and screaming at people, she recalled. He said, people call me a bastard Nazi because I'm loud and I'm German and I'm very demanding. Deckers told her he was German and not Dutch. And again, as we looked at for the record, 484 and 761, according to the BKA, German Federal Police, many of Muhammad Atta's associates in southern Florida were the children of prominent German industrialists. And in a description for the record, 856, the significance of Rick Bolke, again, an apparent protege of a German industrialist named Folker, who was buying up a lot of land in the Pacific Northwest, the significance of Bolke for his alliance with Rudy Deckers, and the significance of Bolke's operations. They apparently were used to recruit German and Arab pilots in Europe and the Middle East for training at Huffman Aviation. So again, Bolke, a protege of the industrialist named Folker, buying up land in the Pacific Northwest, and a key associate of Rudy Deckers, the Muhammad Atta, quote, instructor, unquote. And there's a lot of material in the description for the show that is not in the program proper. This concludes, for the record, 856, Libertarianism, White Supremacy, and Leaderless Resistance. This is being recorded on June 26th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.